Welcome to Simoncast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University in Carbondale. I'm John Shaw, the director of the Institute. In Simoncast, we aim to keep the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well through wide-ranging civil conversations.
And I'm really delighted today to be joined by John Palfrey, who is the president of the MacArthur Foundation, which is based in Chicago. John has a very interesting background. He's a native of Massachusetts, attended Harvard as an undergrad, University of Cambridge, where he did graduate work, and then graduated from law school at Harvard as well. He's had a really wide-ranging professional career. He's worked in venture capital, worked for a law firm where he specialized in intellectual property and internet law. He was a law professor and vice dean at Harvard Law School and was the founding president of the board of directors of the Digital Public Library of America, which has been described as one of the most groundbreaking innovations in library science really ever. So that was a really important initiative. He served on the board of the Knight Foundation for more than a decade and 6 years as its chairman. Prior to assuming the presidency of MacArthur in 2019, he was the head of school at Phillips Academy in Andover for 7 really consequential years. John has written or co-written 10 books, including The Connected Parent, An Expert Guide to Parenting in a Digital World, another book called Safe Spaces, Brave Spaces, Diversity and Free Expression in Education, and another one called Born Digital, How Children Grow Up in a Digital Age. So we have lots of interesting things to talk to John about. So John is joining us from his home in Chicago. So good morning, John.
Good morning, John. Thanks so much for having me.
Great. Well, John, your background is so interesting. And I want to pick up with one kind of little family factoid that I was really struck by, which is you are the great, great grandson of Theodore Roosevelt. And also a grandfather worked for the Atomic Energy Commission and the Kennedy administration. So not to spend all the time on family history, but first of all, the Teddy Roosevelt connection. Was TR a part of the family lore growing up?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. Those are both true statements. I feel on some level, there's always Teddy Roosevelt on my shoulder a little bit as a great-great-granddad. Also, because I didn't grow up with his last name, it was a little bit easier that I didn't carry it around, I think, as some people have. But, you know, I think it's we all have a legacy in terms of how we're born and what our families bring, you know, sometimes they are heavier or more complicated than others. Sometimes they're more helpful. And in some case, you know, I think it's something that can just serve as an inspiration. So I try to think about the great things that TR did and the kind of civic spirit he brought, recognizing, of course, his many flaws and the things he did that weren't so good and trying to not to hold him up on a pedestal all the time, but to take inspiration from what he did.
And then the grandfather worked in the Atomic Energy Commission for the Kennedy administration. Was that part of the family discussion? I mean, just sort of public affairs?
Yeah, very much. So my grandfather also was named John Palfrey. He was a lawyer. He was a law professor and dean of Columbia College. And along the way, he was appointed by President Kennedy to be on the Atomic Energy Commission. And, you know, he was someone I knew. I didn't know Teddy Roosevelt, obviously, we didn't overlap, but I did overlap with my grandfather. And, you know, what I remember of him really was sort of global public policy, was sitting up on watching a little tiny TV and watching the Shah of Iran, you know, kind of drama in the late 70s. And he, that's kind of the reference point for me with him, was he was a lovely, thoughtful, civic spirited guy, but who really did think about, you know, his role in the world and all of our role in the world. So it was definitely a dinner table conversation kind of thing.
Right. Well, John, let's talk about your time at Andover. And I was looking at a video of the state or the ceremony announcing your appointment. Very enthusiastic affair. And during that, you said you referred to this, your coming appointment is the most important calling I could imagine. And then I saw a video of you 7 years later as you were leaving, and you said that you were, quote, forever changed by Andover. Talk about that Andover experience, particularly coming from Harvard, law school, high-powered position there, to transition to be head of school at Andover. I mean, what inspired you to make that shift, and really what its effect on you in terms of your career development?
Well, John, I'm not surprised, given your background as a journalist, that you would have come up with those things. But I'm not sure anybody, including my mother, has watched those two speeches on YouTube or elsewhere. But I am impressed. You know what? I was a professor at Harvard Law School. I was vice dean. I had a wonderful job. Was involved in a research center called the Berkman Center that I loved. And you know, my wife loved living in Cambridge, and we had kids who were in grade school. So it was not an obvious career move to move to a boarding school and become a head of school. But the topic I was interested in, particularly at the time, and has continued to hold my interest, has been how young people are growing up in this digital age, and you know, not knowing exactly whether it's positive or negative, and how it was shaping their brains and their experiences, and really how they learn. And so it took me a little by surprise that I ended up taking the job and moving, or all of us, our family, to move. But it really was a profound experience to be there. And I do think, as I scroll to the end of that 7 years, the most remarkable thing, and you probably get this to some degree now working in a university, is having that front row seat on the development of young people, in this case, age 13, 14 to age, you know, 17, 18, 19, when they're going off to college. In your case, of course, older students. But that's an amazing privilege. And in this case, in a boarding school, you are with them 24/7. It's what's called in loco parentis. So you're sort of, in theory, a parent to 1,100 kids. It's a pretty dramatic experience.
Well, John, I also happened to watch a video that the Andover students put together when you left, and it was, you know, goodbye, Mr. Palfrey. And it was remarkably touching, in which the students would talk. There's one young lady who talked about bumping into her first day at freshman year, introduced herself. And she said for the next 4 years, every time she would see you would remember her name. And others talked about you having lunch with students and attending concerts and sporting events. I mean, what was, tell us about that just sort of decision to just be all in and just fully become immersed in that community.
Well, I do miss that. And, you know, I think whenever you have a job, I'm sure like yours now or mine now, you think about what's kind of special about this job. And I also think, particularly in the head job or the CEO job, or the director job, what can only I do? And it felt to me that one of the things that only I could do was to be the head of school and to, you know, be there at key moments in the lives of young people. And admittedly, I studied that. It was actually a literal Facebook for years to try to get students' names down. And I sometimes, walking around Chicago, someone will shout across the street, "Hey, Mr. Palfrey," and it'll take me the beat or two before they come across to see if I can come up with their name, because I used to have it. But anyway, that was definitely a part of what I thought was fun. And if I, you know, when I reflect on what is the most sort of joyful and memorable specific experience of having that job, it was, think about a crisp fall New England day, and you are, the bells start tolling in the chapel. And as the head of school, you walk out of your office 10 a.m. or whatever, amidst this unbelievable sea of 1,100 kids from all over the world, you know, need blind school, every possible race, ethnicity, background, gender, sexuality, and they're all swarming into this chapel to hear you talk to them for half an hour. Really, that's an amazing experience to look out, you know, on those kids and to have that ability to shape them. Now, whether they remember a thing I said, I don't know. But that may be true, maybe apocryphal line from Maya Angelou seems to me the most important one is, even if you don't remember all the words, you remember how someone made you feel. And so I really thought that my, you know, my principal job as head of that school was to make students feel seen, included, you know, belonging, because, you know, I wasn't their teacher in most cases, I wasn't their coach. But I think if they felt that they belong there, that they were included there, that they'd be able to do their best work to grow in the best possible way. So anyway, that was my game plan. And I do, it brings back memories. Thank you. It was definitely a deep experience.
Great. Well, John, when you were announced as the president of MacArthur, it was, I think, in March in 2019. And in the statement, you were quoted as saying, excuse me, "I'm an optimist who believes that creativity, rigor, and selective disruption can make outsized social impact possible." I want to play on just those basic concepts in terms of, you know, creativity, rigor, and also selective disruption, because the word disruption is used a lot. And in the context of your remarks, what were you thinking when you made that reference?
Yeah, I mean, this is at a moment when, exactly 5 years ago, and it's pre-COVID. Think back, you know, to where we were, in the middle, I think, of a great deal of societal change, though, already. And just thinking about what the role philanthropy can and should play, the reason to take a job as head of a foundation or in a field where you have the ability to make change, which you really do in this space, is to imagine a better world. And my sense was in 2019, my sense 5 years later is quite the same, that our world is messed up in a variety of ways. And to the extent that we want to make it better, we have to break some things, to break down some things in order to remake them in a better way. And I think in a thoughtful fashion, aphilanthropy can be part of that. You can't do it on your own. You are much more the venture capitalist, if you will, than the operating company, or you're the donor as opposed to the, you know, actor. But you can incentivize certain things. You can help with various transitions. And I know we'll come to some of the things we're doing at MacArthur, but I think MacArthur's special sauce is we really invest in very creative people who are making and remaking society in an image that is more inclusive, that is more just, that is more peaceful, in our case, also more verdant. So that really, I think, is the job, is how do you support that kind of change? It's actually very hard to pick the people who get the, you know, grants and the support, because there are so many worthy things out there. But I think if you choose well and you choose the disruptors who are actually going to remake it, not just throw bombs, but actually rebuild, I think there's a lot you can do.
Right. And just to give a couple numbers, MacArthur started, I think, in 1970 and now has about $8 billion in assets. And I was reading a profile of MacArthur in Inside Philanthropy, which is a trade publication. And this was maybe going back some years, but they referred to MacArthur as a sprawling beast of a funder with more than 18 programs on his website, plus various special projects and research networks. And I know one of the decisions that your predecessor made was to try to sharpen the focus, to kind of narrow down the orientation of MacArthur, and inaugurated a program called Big Bets. So talk a little bit about sort of the concept behind Big Bets and how you view that approach to philanthropy.
John, all accurate. You know, I think with big funders who have a great deal of money in the bank and therefore can support a lot of things, it's natural for your programs to grow over time. I bet, I don't know because I wasn't working there, but I bet that all of those 18 programs and special initiatives were laudable. I'm very willing to say that that was all money well spent. The grantees were doing good work. So this is not a critique of that in any way. But I think it is a question of how you can have the most impact. And I think the board at that time and my predecessor, Julie Stash, did a wonderful job, as painful as I'm sure it was, to sunset some programs. And I've had to do some of that sunsetting too, that was, you know, sort of pre-planned over time, but then to concentrate those bets in ways that are going to have more impact over time. So effectively, I think what this is about is saying, with more focus and a sense of what you're trying to get to, that a philanthropy like MacArthur can have a bigger impact. Now, I want to insist on one thing, which is we actually do big bets, but we also do non-big bet type philanthropy. So we take a portfolio approach. I'll take the MacArthur Fellows Program, what we're best known for. In that case, out of the 300 million people in the United States, we choose 20 to 26, plus minus, to give an unrestricted grant to. They get $800,000. They can spend it any way they want over 5 years to just be creative and do what they do. That's the antithesis, in a way, of big bet philanthropy, right? We have no idea what they're going to do. Is Ta-Nehisi Coates going to write this amazing next book? You know, is Lin-Manuel Miranda going to write the next Hamilton? You don't know when you give them the grant, right? But the good news is they do, if you do your work well, and it's quite wonderful, but you don't know what it is. Big bet philanthropy is on the other end of the spectrum, in my view, in the sense of saying, okay, we're going to put a lot of money into something pretty concentrated where we have a sense of what we're headed to, and then invest in that. So we do all of that.
Yeah, and I saw in one interview you were talking about philanthropy, and you talked about what you called the longstanding push and pull in the sector between providing bursts of funding in search of acute impact and steady streams of potentially unending support.
Yeah, that's exactly our approach. I don't remember saying that, but I kind of like it. So an example would be Chicago. You and I are coming onto the Zoom from different parts of Illinois, but the MacArthur family made their money here. We have what we call an enduring commitment to Chicago. And as long as I'm here, and I suspect my successors, we're going to be making grants in Chicago. And I see our job in some ways is that we are planting the tiny acorns that are grow into mighty oak trees here in Chicago. I will never see the shade that they throw off, or maybe, you know, our kids' generation will. That's super important to do. At the same time, things are on fire in Chicago. We have a real concern around gun violence disproportionately affecting our communities of color. And we are doing emergency, acute, literal donations that are meant to address something that is, you know, a burning issue in our society. If we don't do some combination of both of those, I think we're making a mistake. If we try to say, okay, we can just address gun violence today without thinking about the root causes, it's never going to end, probably, or at least less likely to. But if we just say, oh, we're only doing this long root cause thing, then you've got people immediately in front of you suffering. And that is the push and pull.
Right. One of the two of the big bets that are winding down, I mean, you've made huge commitments to them. One is in nuclear security, which I think actually ended last year, and then climate solutions in 26. Like in those programs, will you continue supporting, but just in a different, less concentrated way? Or what happens when a program winds down?
Yeah, it's a very, very good question. And, you know, it is the hard part of philanthropy, which is that in order to make some change in your program, you have to stop doing some things. The way we try to do it is with lots of notice, not that people agree with us, but we say we're going to do this over a period of time. And as you've said, with the big bets, we say we're going to make concentrated gifts over the course of 5 to 10 years in each of these areas, and then they're going to sunset, calling out to the field and other funders, it's going to be your turn on this part of nuclear security or this part of work in Nigeria, which ends this year, climate solutions in 2026. And what we're ending in those cases is those strategies, those big bet strategies. And we're trying to give plenty of notice, and we do tie off grants and so forth so that people have some running room to get to their next funders. But it's saying, you know, MacArthur has been a big funder. We're nowhere near the biggest funder in the country. But, you know, there are others who have more money or could do it and need to step in and bring in their own strategies, their own thoughts, and to refresh the approach. If you go back to our mission statement, though, what we are set up to do is to make the world more just, verdant, and peaceful. And in that spirit, when climate solutions ends in 2026, which is our current climate bet, we are going to be in the verdant business. I don't exactly know what that's going to be, but we've had an environment problem. We've had a conservation program. We now have a particular climate program. In the case of nuclear security, peaceful is part of what we do. We continue to fund some grantees who are in the sort of general peace and security space. The Carnegie Endowment for Peace would be an example. We'll continue to do that. But my hunch is, through the big bets and other programs, we're going to find another significant commitment in the peace space. That's my commitment to do. Obviously, the board will have a point of view on that. And my sense is it will just have a different strategy than we had before. And it will also allow, hopefully, for some growth in the field in the meantime. So anyway, we will be back around to these issues, but we're not going in every case going to fund the exact same things. And I think that's important. Should we be funding the same people and same institutions as in 1970 or 1978? Think about what the world would be like. You know, it would not be as diverse as it should be. It would not be as creative as it should be. So some amount of this transition is necessary, even though it's incredibly painful when you do it.
Right. Well, let's talk about, in fact, I think I would say your signature initiative, yours at MacArthur, which is the Press Forward initiative. And let's maybe start out by just talking about the problem, which is something in the order of a third of the newspapers in the United States have closed in the last 20 years. The exact numbers, I think, are in dispute. Something like two-thirds of the jobs in newspaper journalism have been eliminated. And we have what you've described very eloquently as sort of these news deserts throughout the country that have affected our community life and our public life. So what was the problem that energized you and 20 some others of, I think you call them the coalition of the committed or the passionate, but talk about the genesis of Press Forward.
Yeah, so great. Thank you. Yeah, it is easier and more fun to talk about the things we're spinning up than the things that we're winding down. And certainly the focus on local news and our democracy is our latest first ball in, if you will, in terms of the new big bets or second generation of big bets. And it actually comes from the review of our enduring program, which is called Journalism and Media. We did a review, as we do, of all of our work to say, you know, external people say, is it good or not? You will note that in philanthropy, there's very little accountability. You know, we need to not go afoul of the Illinois Attorney General's rules and the IRS, but, you know, if we do a good job versus a great job, I might lose my job. But, you know, the difference there is there's not much accountability. So we have to bring it in ourselves. So we had outside people review our program in Journalism Media. And what they came back with was, what you're doing is really important. So we've supported NPR, PBS, lots of, you know, public media for decades. We've supported independent film, made that space much more diverse in terms of who tells the stories, what the stories are about, participatory media for young people. The reviewers came back and said, this is great. And there's this other massive crisis that you're really not focused on, which is in local news. So we had an interesting board conversation, which was, do we shift the resources from this one area that is clearly going well in the review and is necessary over to this other area or not? And I will say the members of that journalism team said, you know, you better not, because they really wanted to keep doing that work. And you know, we had a robust conversation about it. What we decided to do was to use an ampersand and do and, right, do, if we could do more. And then we looked at it and we said, okay, if we continue doing this work, and obviously continue to refine it, the previous work, and we add in local news, do we have enough? Does MacArthur Foundation have enough to make a real difference? And so here's the math. We decided a big bet for over a five-year period could be a commitment of about $150 million. So $30 million a year. Plus I'm investing, we're committing to invest impact investing funds, another $25 million. That's a floor, not a ceiling. But so think about $175 million. And we looked at the program problem out there, and it looked like it was more like a problem with billions involved, not hundreds of millions. So we said, let's do it, but let's see if we can get other people along. And you referenced the Coalition of the Enthusiastic. We did something unusual. I took off my fund giving hat and put on a fund raising hat. You referenced my previous jobs, which were all about fundraising on some level. And I called around other foundations, a little bit of a sneak attack when another foundation president comes and asks you for money, because you think you're safe to be asked for money, which is what happens all day long. And then they ask you. Anyway, last fall, 22 of us agreed to commit over $500 million over the next 5 years towards the local news crisis. That number is now 57 funders across the country who have committed. So it continues to gain momentum. But even with that amount of money, we are not going to solve it alone. This is a problem that, as you said, is extremely profound. 2 to 2.5 newspapers a week are failing in America. Tens of thousands of journalism jobs gone. You know, very large swaths of America without any local news coverage, and real risk for our democracy. So we are not promising to be the end-all, be-all, messiah, savior, none of that. But we do think that philanthropy can play a big role in the coming, you know, five plus years.
Well, you had an essay in The Atlantic where you're talking about this initiative, and you made a really, I think this was the beginning of the article, really kind of personal reference to when you were at Andover, I guess 2012, and there was a very robust local newspaper, and they, you know, were kind of knocking at your door and asking impertinent questions, and maybe at times, you know, being more critical than seemed warranted. But you appreciated the fact that this was, I mean, they were a robust and an important part of the community. And by the time you left in 2019, that newspaper had dwindled to just a shell of itself. And it had a really profound effect on the community. I mean, talk about just your own specific, you know, reflections on the Andover paper and how its contraction affected the community that you were living in.
Yeah, thank you for retelling that story. The paper is called The Andover Townsman. You know, I think it had been around as a very meaningful newspaper that covered as basically a weekly, a 35,000 person town. It had little ads in it. It had every Little League game was covered, and every, you know, town meeting was covered, and all the rest. And you know what? I read it literally word for word every week. I was not alone. Print version in my office. You know, they did have a little really bad website, but it was, you know, I actually, you know, had it handed to me, and from 2012 to whatever it was, 2019, I guess, in my inbox. And it was meaningful. And yes, they were a thorn in my side. I thought they were totally unfair on one big topic. It not worth going into unless you want to. But, you know, I thought they got it totally wrong. We were being very good citizens and engaged and generous, and they thought we were not. It was a total pain. I had to explain it to the trustees who also got the newspaper. Like, it was a total pain. But when I realized how important it was that somebody do hold all of us to account, I actually had a lot of power in that town, as it turned out. And it just, it seems necessary. And by the end, as I told in that little Atlantic story, the goodbye story about me written in 2019 as I was leaving was written by a young woman. I think she might have been about 3 months out of college, something like that, 6 months out of college. She was the only employee. She was not actually working in that town even. She was in a local, another place, regional. So it had been turned out. So there was no dedicated person in that town. She came over. She met me for the first time to do my goodbye interview. She had no idea who I was or any context. And it was a perfectly nice piece. I'm sure it's still out there on the internet. I'm not complaining. It was probably a puff piece, good enough about me. But the point was, it wasn't, you know, John Cha, who's been, you know, doing this for 20 years and had been actually reading and actually, she had no idea who I was. She had done no homework, but she was writing seven stories a week or whatever she was doing, which was all that was in that. And I actually looked her up to see, was she still there? You know, I think she was there for a year. I mean, I think they literally, again, perfectly fine person. I think she's now a, you know, PR person for some other, like, it's not, it wasn't professional journalism focused on the town. And we need that. We need that in small towns and in big cities.
Yeah, I'll just make it kind of personal. I mean, several people have asked me, you know, in terms of SIU, if I could propose one reform. And I said to have a really, really aggressive local newspaper with a reporter whose, you know, beat was the university and whose mandate was to ask all the hard, probing, difficult questions, because there's nothing, I mean, in terms of just forcing you to clarify your own thinking, and to really make sure that the arguments that you're making are solid, there, you know, maybe it's an old-fashioned view, but there's really nothing like a hard-hitting journalist probing to make you think in really important ways.
Yeah, I mean, it takes one to know one, I'm sure. And you come at it honestly. You may be the only person in an administrative role who thinks that, but I think you're totally right. You know, I'll say even on Press Forward, you know, one of the things that's come up has been, It may be a surprise to those not working in philanthropy that those of us in philanthropy get criticized a lot for what we do or don't do. It's just kind of how it goes. And it's fine. Again, there's very little accountability and there should be that. But I've not gotten any more critique on anything we've done, even when we've exited programs, than from the journalist space while we've gotten in it. There are so many views and people are critically, you know, complaining about us not giving money out fast enough or not giving it to the right people. But you know what? We have to be okay with that. We have to be okay. I don't think it's a good long-term strategy for journalists. I can go into that if it's interesting. But I also think that it is necessary for us to have some, you know, holding of account in a variety of ways. And one of the tricky things is going to be, we're going to have people who are in the business of funding small town, you know, papers or whatever as donors, and they're going to have to be covered like everybody else. I don't think that I don't think it's a good long-term strategy is I don't think journalists should go out of their way to be more mean to somebody who is giving money. And that's where I think there may need to be some calibration in this next period. But I do think that making sure that everybody is held equally to account is a part of what will make democracy go.
Well, John, let me kind of have broaden the frame a little bit. And it's from an essay that you've written recently, because it helps also kind of sharpen the focus on Press Forward. And you wrote, as local newsrooms disappeared across America, civic engagement has faded, social bonds have frayed, misinformation has surged, and government accountability has dwindled. National outlets, by definition, do not focus on issues of local importance and often focus on the most polarizing, sensationalized subjects. Without no local newsrooms, there is an information vacuum that leaves people without the facts they need to participate in their community meetings, speak with their local school boards, and make their views heard at the polls. So, John, kind of make that the connection between this kind of collapse of local news and some of the struggles our democracy is going through right now.
Yeah, I mean, linking this up to the work of your center, your institute, and of course the legacy of Senator Simon, you know, I think this is fundamentally about making sure our democracy can work in the 21st century. And so if you put in front of me a donor or a prospective partner, what I would say, they're saying, why should we give money to this instead of, you know, you listed climate, nuclear, you know, we didn't talk about artificial intelligence, but all the other things you could be funding. Why should you give money to local news? Like, why should you give it to that reporter, beat reporter on the ground? Because it is ultimately, you're making a choice. I think it is fundamentally about making sure that democracy can work. So if it's okay, I'm going to go back to the founding of this country, you know, and think about what the founders were arguing about with the Federalist and Anti-Federalist. In the Federalist Papers, one thing they worried about was we would get to a scale where you could, democracy wouldn't hold, right? And the factions would take over and so forth. The founders, as usual, in this case, they were right. They saw what was potentially happening. They were seeing some of this polarization that was possible. And I think the antidote to that is strong local communities and focus on local issues, because I think one of the things that's happened, social media is partly to blame. Certainly the cable networks are partly to blame, of course, national outlets in some ways, but it has made more sense to divide people based on partisan interests or tendencies and to sell to that, and then to have the advertising and so forth follow the polarization, as opposed to what brings us together. And you think about in our communities, what brings us together? It's a kid going to Quiz Bowl. It's a football team or a softball team doing really well and going to the States. Those are the things that we all come together around. They may not be the school board. That's also important. They may be, why do you like ice cream or not like ice cream? I don't know what it might be, but things that actually make people see themselves as part of a community bring us back together. And I think it then makes you more likely to invest. And the data will show this, which is a town with really good local newspapers. You can say it's correlation or causation. We can get into the academic debate, but they're more likely to have a higher rate of people voting in a municipal election. The places that had lower rates of people voting in municipal elections, including places with single digit turnouts in our country for municipal elections, are places that are more likely to have no local news, to have more corruption, to have higher costs, literally, of issuing bonds for the town if you have no local news. Why? Bond issuers want some accountability. It actually literally costs you money not to have local news in your community. So there are all sorts of reasons why this is a very important public good. And I think it links back to the health of our democracy in a fundamental way.
Well, John, let's zero in on the mechanics of Press Forward. And particularly there's 17, as I understand it, locals based in geographical places, two of which are in Illinois. And yep. One of them that is particularly interesting to me is Chicago, because as you point out, Chicago is actually kind of a news oasis. I mean, it's a vibrant news community, but certainly communities have been historically unreported on and unacknowledged. But talk about how you want Press Forward to work in Chicago. And I think you can see Chicago becoming a sort of a national exemplar of how this new system can work.
That's the game plan. Absolutely. We intend on it. So if you zoom back out, I'm going to do the same thing as with the founders. If you think about $500 million over 5 years, you break that down, $100 million a year, 50 states, couple million dollars. Like, there's no way that even if we just spread the peanut butter around the different cities and towns around America, that it would make that much difference. It'd be fine. It'd be helpful to people, pay some salaries for a year, but it wouldn't cover every town. It would not be enough. So we have to do something that shows the way, that gets other people in. So a couple things I think have to happen nationally. One is we have to get more people seeing that they have to pay for local news, whether that's subscribing to a newspaper, whether it's becoming a member of a public media, television station or NPR station, giving money in their local community, being philanthropists, seeing local news. So we have to get more people in the game. That's why I'm much more focused on this number 57, which is 57 donors that we have in now, many of whom have never given to local news, giving money across the country. And our game plan, as you said, is on a local basis to get more and more places across the country. I'd love to see in 50 states an effort. So we have a group in Alaska who is, I can tell you, they are on fire to make local news a big deal in Alaska in this new era. We've got Wyoming, another state. We've got Wichita, where I was last week. Across the country, we're seeing enthusiasm for this approach. They're part of a network. And yes, we're putting a little bit of seed money into these efforts, but it's mostly just saying to local people, you want to have a robust ecosystem and city and civic life in Wichita, people in Wichita are going to have to step up. They're going to have to subscribe. They're going to have to become members. They're going to have to give money. Otherwise, these things aren't going to exist for forever. So zooming in on our home city, and this goes back to your point about enduring commitments, we recognize that the MacArthur family made their money here in Chicago, essentially through Bankers Life and Trust. And so we have an obligation to do good work here. It's not all the money we're giving, but we're going to make sure that Chicago has a really robust effort. So Press Forward Chicago itself has about $10 million committed from us and a bunch of other generous donors. And we're in the first phases of giving it out to a number of organizations. But across Chicago, there are more than 100 news outlets covering the 3 million people who are here in the 77 neighborhoods of Chicago. So there is a really exciting story, and I'm calling it a news oasis as compared to the news deserts that are elsewhere. And if we can help show with our support and with the incredible creativity that we're seeing from our partners across Chicagoland, if we can show that this is doable, and it actually can be vibrant, and it has a huge impact on economic development, on people turning out for voting, all those kinds of things, I think it can revitalize the story. So we can't solve everything across America. I think about Massachusetts, where I grew up, 351 cities and towns. MacArthur in Chicago can't do that. There's no way. But can we help make Chicago a really great exemplar and then have some stories and knowledge from there spread out and have donors get excited, have community members get excited? I think that's doable.
Well, John, talk about the Springfield Initiative. I think one of the main forces is the Land of Lincoln Community Foundation that is also working. Talk about what its focus is, and is it specifically on reporting in Springfield, or is it also covering the state capitol? Because I guess that's a separate issue about the just stunning decline in reporting of, you know, state legislatures, where, you know, which have become increasingly the scene of really important action in the public policy front.
Absolutely, yeah. And this is, we are still figuring out Press Forward. This is a nascent effort, and we welcome other people to join in, help shape it, write checks and be part of it. But if you think about a state, and Illinois is a great example, you know, it does have this incredible, iconic third biggest city in the country in Chicago, but there are a whole lot of other, you know, counties and towns and so forth. And the state capital, importantly, Springfield, is not Chicago. So the Community Foundation of Land of Lincoln raised its hand very early in Press Forward. They put up $1 million they had. We matched that with another million from MacArthur to get something going in Springfield. And I would imagine it's up to the Community Foundation how they want to do it and their partners. But I would imagine exactly the two things you described, both the city of Springfield itself, an important community, and the state capital, which must be covered. And my sense is, I should know the exact numbers, but it was, you know, dozens of people a day were covering things in the state capital, down to now, you know, probably on one hand. Somebody told me it's maybe 3 to 4 really dedicated people kind of day to day. And whether that's exactly right or not, that you get the sense of scale, you know, there are crucial things happening up on the Capitol. And we know in Illinois that not everybody has been doing things above board. Let's be clear, like, there needs to be some accountability from a good governance perspective. And while there are some amazing kind of statewide efforts, I would, you know, Better Government Association and Justice Watch, others that are really trying to do very thoughtful work from places like Chicago, but there needs to be support in Springfield itself. And then, you know, the part that is left to be done would be, should we do a Press Forward Illinois more broadly? Because Carbondale has needs and so forth, to your point about somebody actually deeply covering the university as an example. So we haven't gotten as far as we need to yet, but I think you're describing correctly some of how an architecture could come about, which is, you know, a deep dose in the big city of Chicago, prove the case, make sure our capital and the capital city is well covered. But we need people to raise their hands elsewhere. Again, we can't do it all with our cash. It's just not enough. But we're happy to match. We're happy to travel. I enjoyed traveling to do the kickoff for the Press Forward in Springfield. We will get in our cars and get on the road. We've been doing a whistle stop tour across America, and, you know, and help set this up. But my hunch is you're going to need statewide efforts. You're going to need local efforts, probably state capital efforts, and we'll see how that plays out.
Well, John, so after 5 years, I mean, how will you know if you're on track? I mean, obviously, the world is not going to change. I mean, these are grim trends. But, you know, in 5 years, what will persuade you that, you know what, we have actually changed the paradigm here?
When I've been asking people for money, which is more or less all I've been doing for 18 months to get Press Forward going, I say, I'm coming for you in 4.5 years, just so you know. Like, yes, you're making a 5-year commitment, but we're coming back. And I'm coming back from my board. We, you know, I want to make this very successful. And I think it's better seen as a 10-year initiative than a 5-year, but, you know, we'll see. And we're working with our partners to come up with really precise goals. And part of this is really trying to listen to the field. We're trying to listen to journalists who have a lot of points of view on this, as you know, people who are leading organizations, people living in communities. So we will come with some very specific targets. But a few things that I would note: I think the field needs to be more diverse and needs to be covering more diverse communities. I know we can accomplish some of that. We are accomplishing some of that with our grants. We have wonderful staff who are focused on that. I think we can change the culture some, of people seeing local news as something that they need to contribute to. Every one of us, you and I, need to pay more money for local news. We just have to. I don't know how many things you subscribe to or don't, or family members, but we all have to figure out how to do more. I've tried to do that personally, but to encourage everybody to do it. And that looks like big foundations, you know, being in. And there are foundations that have never done local news that are now in for millions of dollars because of this initiative. I know we can do more of that and change that thinking. You know, and I do think fundamentally we can prove the case, probably not across America in 5 to 10 years, but we can prove it in some places. And that's why the local strategy is where our emphasis is now. Again, we don't have enough to fund in every one of the towns out there across the country, but we can catalyze change and get other people to do that and have some bright spots. So it's not going to be the same in East Lansing, Michigan, as it is in Biloxi. It's not going to be the same in Chicago or even Springfield or Carbondale, right? So what we need, I think, are a mix of things that show what's possible and what's robust. In some small towns, it may be one person with a Substack who's doing a great job and gets enough money to sustain themselves. It may be it's something like Block Club that is across 77 neighborhoods. It might be like City Bureau, which is sending out documenters to different places, and on. I can describe many different exciting things that are going on. But we need to prove that case in a bunch of different types so that different communities can say, okay, we need this too. We may not be getting MacArthur's money or Press Forward's money, but this is showing a way that it can work in this big city or in this small town.
Right. John, one thing I'd like to ask you about is just as sort of a management tool. I really, in researching this interview, I was really struck by your use of this device called the President's Essay, which you've done for 3 or 4 or 5 years. And it's this wonderful way of just kind of crystallizing what is most important to you. The online version has wonderful links to interviews and so forth. But tell me about the kind of the genesis of the President's Essay and how you try to use that as a device to kind of shape the work of MacArthur.
Well, Jen, you and I have a mutual friend in Kristen Mack, who's our vice president for communications and partnerships in our fellows program. And it's very much a device developed in concert with Kristen and her team. And yes, I mean, part of it is to say all the things we do are crucial. And to my point before, you know, there, even the things we've exited are also crucial. But it is important, I think, every once in a while to focus in on a few of our partners and on our efforts. And, you know, in this year, it was an election year, obviously. So I did focus on this topic of bringing people together, arguing better across divides, the kinds of things I think we need to do. And the videos are a device, not probably unlike the device of this program you have at your institute, is really to highlight people that I think are doing interesting things among our partners, whether co-funders or grantees, and potentially people who might not be in either of those categories, but are just doing interesting work. And I do think that's one of the benefits of a big foundation, a national foundation. That's probably a little unlike, say, a community foundation, which has other strengths closely tied to community. But a national foundation can put somebody into a national discourse in a slightly different way. I think that's why the MacArthur Fellows Program is so powerful, because we are in some ways saying, look at this person and the work they have done and what they will do. It's going to be awesome. It's already awesome, and you may not have paid attention to it. And so I think in some ways, the President's Essay can help do that, particularly with those little videos.
Well, John, I have to ask you this. What is the best part of your job, and what is the most frustrating or difficult?
Well, I obviously say the second one is that I have to say no all day long to amazing people and amazing ideas. And anybody who has been in a program officer's job or a director's job or a president's job of a foundation knows that that's what you do most of the time, all day long. And people will come and say, you know, you do racial justice, we do racial justice, we're doing this amazing thing. And having to say to that amazing person, no, I can't give you money because either budget's spent or we're doing something else or it's off strategy, that's all day long. And it's miserable, but it is also how it goes. So nobody needs to cry for me. I have the best job in the world, but that is a pain. But of course, the flip side of it is that, you know, we are able to put capital in the hands of people who really need it and are going to do amazing things with it. And, you know, whether that's in the field of the reform of our criminal justice system, our safety and justice challenge, to figure out how do you safely reduce the average daily jail population in 50 communities across America and prove that individuals do not need to be detained pretrial, can be back in their homes and doing jobs in the way, you know, we over-incarcerate like crazy, and we can do that while keeping our community safe. Or we're putting money in the hands of an artist who has never been celebrated the same way before, or we're putting money in the hands of a woman who's been in a lab in their university, has never been noticed before, but their work has been unbelievable. And all of a sudden they are receiving, you know, major federal grants and have a brand new lab when they become a MacArthur Fellow. All of these are stories that I've heard from people, you know, that are made possible by what we get to do every day. And amazingly, someone pays us to do every day at foundations.
Well, I read one of your colleagues said that one of your special skills is the ability to connect theory and practicality. And he cited your work at Andover as, you know, you went into that with sort of a theory of of, you know, how this digital world was altering education. You were able to both run the school really well, but also to kind of hone your thinking. Has your work at MacArthur, is it the genesis of a new book on foundations and their role in American life? Or do you have another book coming, I guess, is where I'm going.
You're so nice, John. Yeah, so I will probably not write a book about foundations. There's so many that have been written. My friend Darren Walker has written, I think, two at Ford Foundation, one fairly recent. Our colleague Raj Shah has one out called On Big Bets. There's some wonderful ones, critical ones of foundations. I could go down the list and give a reading list, but I don't think anybody needs to hear from me about foundations. I am working on a couple books, though. That's always true. One I'm working on right now is it's focused on older adults and how they use technology, writing with a woman, amazing professor named Esther Hargitay at University of Zurich. That will be out next year from University of Chicago Press. And that's like Born Digital, which you mentioned before, which was focused on how kids are using digital technologies. This is about how older people, 60 plus, are using them. I'm not yet in that category myself, but very interested in it. And I think we have not focused enough on older adults. And one of the reasons that I focused on this topic is actually the MacArthurs in 1970, when they created the foundation, they really said, you can do anything you want with the money. So there are no specific donor constraints or intent, but they mentioned two things in the charter, and one of them is looking after, I think they use the term retired persons, but the interests of older adults, basically. And so I thought, you know, while I'm here, maybe I will focus deeply on this question, learn about it, work with a scholar who's worked in the space, bring some of what I know about digital technologies to bear. And so in some ways, it's an analog to Born Digital as to Kids. This one will be called Wired Wisdom, I think, is the likely name at this moment. And it's in peer review. So if it gets positive peer reviews, it'll be out next spring.
Well, John, just kind of to play off that, we had an event a couple months ago with Jim Nolan, who's written a book on politics, and it's for young people on how they can start careers in politics. And in one of the Q&A, someone had sent a note saying to Mr. Nolan, well, what can some of us who are senior citizens, some of us who are retired, what can we do to help promote our democracy? How can you use our skills in a way that that can help bolster this democracy? So maybe some of that kind of question could also be integrated into some of your work.
I love it. Absolutely. You know, and I think for older adults who might be watching this, I mean, one is intergenerational connection is really powerful. So the, you know, people who have been, you know, as Senator Simon was, as you've been, you know, in and around Washington, being mentors for people who are, you know, 18 to 22 coming into their sort of moment of fear and wonder about the world that lies ahead, and mentoring, I mean, that is so powerful. I would also just note, you know, older adults are the ones who are sustaining newspapers right now. If you look at those who actually pay for print newspapers, the latest data I saw looked at 4% of Americans, almost all of whom are over 65. So, you know, older adults are my heroes right now. They are paying the bills for a lot of journalistic work and paying a lot of mortgages for and rents for a lot of journalists out there. So we need our older adults staying long and strong, paying the bills, and encouraging younger people to follow their lead.
Great. Well, John, final question. I like to ask guests, what they have learned in their careers that they would pass on to, you know, their 22-year-old self, or, you know, in this case, we have, you know, new group of graduates at SIU graduate at the end of the week. Schools across Illinois and the country are getting ready for graduation. I mean, if you could, what sort of advice would you give to young people as they launch their careers based on what you've learned?
Well, you've kindly quoted me throughout this in lots of ways, so I'll just draw and be repetitive. But, I do think that hope and optimism and keeping a sense of what's possible in front of you and seeing how your life, whether it's your personal life or your professional life, contributes to the world you want to live in. So if you believe, as I do, we need a stronger, more supportive, more multiracial democracy in America, go do it. Like, find something, whether it's being a lawyer in a law firm, as many of I'm still a visiting professor of law once a year, go do that. That's great. Stand up for the rule of law. And by the way, be a pro bono lawyer for some people who need the help. You know, be on a board of a nonprofit news organization and give them some money. Like, no matter who we are, what we do, get in the game. And democracy, it has to be a verb. It has to be a sport or an activity as opposed to just a noun. And no matter what our work is or our home situation is, we can pitch in there.
I had a conversation with a diplomat who I've known for many years, and I've sort of said, asked the same question to him. And his answer is pithy. He says, no one can do everything. Everyone can do something. And just that same thing of finding the way that you can make a contribution.
Now, he said it better than I did, but that's the answer, I think.
Great. Well, John, thank you for such a terrific conversation and really the important work you're doing at MacArthur. And I'm not going to put you on the spot here, but I'm thinking of maybe finding a train ticket for you and having you come down to Southern Illinois and to tell, you know, this story of Press Forward and MacArthur to communities down here that I think desperately need to hear a solution for a problem that they find really worrisome, because they as news deserts spread throughout this part of the state, there is concern and there is a real desire to figure out a way forward on this.
Well, John, let's do it, and we'll buy our own train tickets, and I bet I have a couple colleagues who will join me in the Carbondale Sprint, and let us know when we're welcome, and we'll definitely do it.
That would be perfect. Well, John, thank you again so much.
Thanks, John. Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to SimonCast, the official podcast of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. SimonCast is produced in collaboration with WSIU Public Radio. You can find SimonCast wherever you listen to podcasts, including NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and more. Please subscribe to new episodes as soon as they're posted and tell your friends about our show. For more information, visit paulsimoninstitute.org. Thank you for listening, and thank you for keeping the legacy of Paul Simon alive and well.